continuous glucose monitoring, biofeedback for type 2, diabetes patients, executive summary. A small wire under the skin is rewriting how clinicians and patients understand type 2 diabetes. Continuous glucose monitoring, CGM, gives patients a live look at a signal that used to be invisible. It is glycemic biofeedback, and like all good biofeedback, it does more than display numbers. It teaches the body to listen to itself. CGM once lived in specialty endocrinology clinics, paired with insulin pumps and prescribed cautiously. Now it sits on pharmacy shelves and shows up on wrists. FDA clearance of the first over-the-counter sensor opened the door, and updated professional standards have widened it further. For adults with type 2 diabetes, CGM earns its keep when it surfaces daily patterns that finger sticks and quarterly labs routinely miss. The biology behind avoiding repeated post-meal spikes is well-grounded, and consensus targets for time and range support it. But 160 mg DL is best understood as a yellow light, not a guillotine. Many consensus reports flag clinically important highs as time spent above 180 mg DL. The distinction matters at the bedside. One brief peak proves nothing. A repeated pattern of peaks is a conversation worth having. CGM can reveal silent excursions between 160 and 180 mg DL that patients never feel, and that quarterly hemoglobin A1C values quietly average away. That visibility pays off when it leads to specific, testable experiments with food order, walking, sleep, and medication review. The same visibility can backfire when it generates uninterpreted alarms, perfectionism, or shame. Clients should not chase every glucose peak. They should turn patterns into safe, psychologically informed decisions. Behavioral health clinicians have a particular contribution to make. They can help clients receive sensor data as feedback rather than surveillance, especially when shame, perfectionism, disordered eating, or diabetes distress are already in the room. A sensor turns glucose into a story. Continuous glucose monitoring, CGM, is a wearable system that estimates glucose around the clock through a small filament tucked just under the skin. In type 2 diabetes, where insulin resistance and declining insulin production push glucose upward, the sensor turns an invisible signal into a readable pattern. Watching glucose unfold in real time is glycemic biofeedback. The patient sees the body's response to a meal, a walk, a rough night, or a tough phone call, and adjusts accordingly. The sensor does not measure blood directly. It samples interstitial fluid, the watery medium that surrounds and bathes body cells. Glucose moves from the blood to this fluid with a brief delay, producing what clinicians call sensor lag. During steady periods, the lag is barely there. During rapid changes, such as the minutes after juice or a sprint, the screen value can trail the true value by 10 to 15 minutes. Clinicians who teach this up front spare patients a lot of frustration. This shapes how a CGM reading should be read. The number on the screen is not a moral score, a diagnosis, or a perfect laboratory value. It is a trend line. The most useful clinical question is rarely, "What is the value?" It is closer to, "What pattern is this showing, and what safe experiment could we run together?" Two forces have driven the rapid uptake of CGM. People with diabetes want richer feedback than a single morning finger stick can provide. People without diabetes are increasingly curious about glucose as a wellness metric. FDA clearance of the first over-the-counter sensor expanded access for the second group, and updated diabetes technology standards encourage earlier and broader use in clinical care. Healthy users may discover that soda, a late dinner, poor sleep, or a stressful meeting nudges their curve. They may have no idea what to do with the observation. There is still no widely accepted framework for interpreting routine CGM patterns in people without diabetes, and a continuous data stream can muddy the water rather than clear it. Why a meal can become a glucose wave. Postprandial glucose, the glucose level after eating, is where many patterns hide. Carbohydrate from a meal breaks down into glucose, enters the bloodstream, and fuels the brain, muscles, and other tissues. Insulin escorts that glucose into cells and smooths the curve. The system is elegant when it works. In insulin resistance, muscle, liver, and fat cells respond sluggishly to insulin. The pancreas compensates by releasing more, but that compensation erodes over the years. Glucose climbs higher after meals and lingers longer than expected, sometimes well past the next one. Glycemic variability describes the up and down movement of glucose across hours and days. Two patients can share an identical average. One rides gentle hills, the other careens through peaks and valleys. CGM is uniquely valuable here because it shows shape, not only altitude. The biological concern is that repeated sharp rises may strain small vessels and nerves over time. Laboratory and clinical studies link acute glucose swings to oxidative stress, the cellular damage that accumulates when reactive molecules overwhelm antioxidant defenses. Those swings may also contribute to endothelial dysfunction, which is impaired health of the blood vessel lining, and to the buildup of advanced glycation end products, AGEs, sticky sugar protein molecules that stiffen tissues over years. Where does 160 mg/dL fit? The International Diabetes Federation suggested a post-meal target below 160 mg/dL when it can be reached safely. Many CGM consensus reports use 70 to 180 mg/dL as the standard target range for non-pregnant adults with diabetes. A spike over 160 is therefore a meaningful early warning signal, not a proven injury switch. That nuance matters at the bedside. A clinician can reasonably ask whether repeated peaks above 160 are modifiable, especially in a patient with neuropathy risk, kidney disease, retinopathy, or cardiovascular disease. It would be too strong to claim that a single 165 mg/dL reading produces measurable damage. The clinical enemy is chronic exposure, not one imperfect dinner. The evidence behind CGM in type 2 diabetes. The evidence for CGM is encouraging, and it is still maturing. The mobile randomized trial in adults with type 2 diabetes treated with basal insulin found that CGM beat fingerstick monitoring on A1C. Systematic reviews and meta-analyses tell a consistent story: modest A1C reduction, more time in range, and less time above range. Most trials are short and were not designed to capture hard complication endpoints. The evidence is widening beyond insulin-treated diabetes. A meta-analysis of randomized trials in non-insulin-treated type 2 diabetes documented improved glycemic control with CGM relative to usual monitoring. A more recent food choice and self-care trial in adults not taking insulin showed substantial within-group improvements with CGM-supported self-care, though it compared two CGM strategies rather than CGM against no CGM. CGM improves outcomes when patients receive enough education, structured feedback, and clinical follow-up to act on the data. The device alone is not the treatment. Interpretation and behavior change are the treatment pathway. A systematic review of randomized trials concluded that CGM feedback can lower A1C and increase time in range, though many studies did not measure exactly which behaviors changed. Awareness appears to be the proximate mechanism. Awareness only helps when it becomes a plan. The problem with averages. Hemoglobin A1C, HbA1c, is a blood test that estimates average glucose exposure across roughly 3 months by measuring the fraction of hemoglobin that has bound glucose inside red blood cells. It is clinically useful and historically central to diabetes care. But an average can hide the daily story, much as a region's average summer temperature hides every heat wave. CGM brings a richer vocabulary. Time and range, TIR, is the percentage of CGM readings within the target range, often 70 to 180 metabolic markers DL for non-pregnant adults with diabetes. Time above range, TAR, is the percentage of readings that exceed the target, often 180 mmHg DL. Time below range, TBR, is the percentage of time spent below target, often below 70 mmHg DL, where safety becomes the dominant clinical priority. Modern CGM reports add three more useful summaries. The glucose management indicator, GMI, translates the average sensor glucose into an A1C-like estimate. The ambulatory glucose profile, AGP, compresses many days of readings into one composite daily pattern that is far easier to read than a wall of raw curves. The coefficient of variation, CV, summarizes how widely glucose values spread around the average. Together, these measures explain a familiar paradox. A patient can post acceptable fasting readings and still experience repeated post-meal peaks between 160 and 180 mg DL. Fasting glucose is a single morning snapshot. A1C is a three-month blur. Neither one reliably reveals whether breakfast, dinner, stress, medication timing, or late-night snacking is the source of the trouble. The spikes are often silent. Many adults do not feel a glucose value of 165 or 175 mmHg, especially when it lasts only 30 minutes. In a large community-based cohort, even adults without diabetes occasionally spent time above 180 mmHg. That finding underscores why a single CGM high is not diagnostic. It must be read alongside meals, activity, sleep, and stress. How spikes may injure small and large vessels. The strongest evidence for complications tied to CGM metrics comes from associations rather than from decades-long randomized trials. That is still clinically meaningful. A patient who spends more time above target and less time in range exposes nerves, kidneys, eyes, and vessels to more cumulative glucose stress. Peripheral neuropathy is damage to nerves of the feet, legs, hands, or arms, often producing numbness, tingling, or burning pain. In adults with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease, lower CGM time in range has been associated with peripheral neuropathy, even when laboratory A1C was less informative. The daily pattern can matter beyond the clinic average. Cardiovascular autonomic neuropathy, KN, is injury to the nerves that regulate heart rate, blood pressure, and circulation. CGM-derived time in range and time above range have both been linked to KN in outpatients with type 2 diabetes. This matters in everyday practice because autonomic symptoms often masquerade as dizziness, exercise intolerance, resting tachycardia, or orthostatic complaints. Retinopathy refers to damage to the small blood vessels of the retina. Nephropathy refers to kidney damage that often begins with albumin leaking into the urine. Studies in type 2 diabetes have linked lower time in range to diabetic retinopathy and to albuminuria. A systematic review concluded that time in range is associated with microvascular outcomes across eye, kidney, and nerve, while flagging that more prospective research is needed. Macrovascular disease involves larger vessels, including coronary, cerebral, and peripheral arteries. Causal evidence linking CGM targets directly to these outcomes is less developed. Glucose swings remain biologically plausible contributors because they appear to amplify oxidative stress, inflammation, and endothelial injury, all of which sit upstream of atherosclerosis. Repeated spikes above 160 micrograms NaDL may cumulatively increase risk, especially when part of a broader pattern of high time above range. The number invites pattern review and prevention rather than panic. One imperfect meal does not write a clinical sentence. What CGM adds to behavioral health care. Diabetes distress is the emotional weight of living with diabetes. It includes worry, frustration, shame, burnout, and the quiet exhaustion of decisions that never end. Diabetes distress is common, prevalent across cultures and care settings, and it independently undermines glycemic control and well-being. Distress is also treatable. A 2024 meta-analysis of randomized trials found that tailored psychological interventions, including cognitive behavioral therapy and mindfulness-based approaches, significantly reduced diabetes distress in adults with type 2 diabetes, with the largest effects in the short term. CGM can ease this picture or worsen it, depending on how the data are framed. The technology can reduce distress by replacing guessing with understandable feedback. It can amplify distress when it becomes a constant reminder that the body is being watched and judged. A recent ecological momentary assessment study using N-of-1 analyses found that perceived glucose levels predicted same-day diabetes distress more reliably than actual CGM-derived values. The story patients tell themselves about their data shapes how those data feel. For clinical psychologists and counselors, CGM functions as a behavioral map. A rise in glucose after a lonely evening snack is not just a nutritional event. It can be the visible footprint of an emotion regulation loop that includes fatigue, deprivation, habit, reward, and self-criticism. Naming the loop is often more therapeutic than naming the carbohydrate. Motivational interviewing is a collaborative counseling style that helps patients connect change to their own values rather than to the clinician's instruction. It pairs naturally with CGM because the data invite curiosity rather than compliance. Useful prompts include what the patient noticed, what surprised them, and which small adjustment feels realistic this week. Hypoglycemia, meaning low glucose and commonly defined as below 70 mg/dL, changes the safety calculus entirely. For patients using insulin or insulin-stimulating medications, the goal of trimming spikes must never produce new lows. Behavioral health clinicians should encourage prompt medical coordination when CGM reveals frequent or overnight lows, or symptoms that do not match the displayed reading. A psychologically informed CGM visit, then, focuses on patterns, preferences, and barriers. It avoids blame language such as bad numbers or failed weeks. It also screens explicitly for perfectionism, disordered eating risk, compulsive checking, and alarm fatigue. The goal is curiosity, not surveillance.
CGM can motivate patients to exercise. For most people, exercise more is advice that goes in one ear and out the other. The patient who dislikes the gym has already heard the guidelines, weathered the warnings about sitting, and nodded politely at the long list of promised benefits. None of it sticks, because none of it pays off today. Even the genuine lift in mood after a brisk walk tends to arrive too quietly and too late to compete with the comfort of the couch. The reward is real, but the brain rarely connects it back to the effort that earned it. Continuous glucose monitoring changes the math by making the payoff impossible to miss. When a patient watches a 15-minute walk shave the top off a post-meal spike, the abstract becomes concrete, and the screen delivers the feedback in minutes rather than months. Meta-analyses of post-meal movement support what the trace shows in real time. Walking soon after eating blunts the glucose rise more effectively than the same walk taken earlier or later. That visible win does double duty, rewarding the behavior on the spot and quietly building the patient's confidence that their own choices move the needle. For someone for whom guidelines, warnings, and promises never reached, the sensor can finally supply the one thing that makes after-meal walking a durable habit, proof that it works.
What CGM can miss, mislead, or magnify, CGM has practical limits that matter clinically. Because the sensor estimates glucose from interstitial fluid, rapid changes can show up late on the screen. Pressure on the sensor during sleep can occasionally produce falsely low readings. Skin irritation from adhesives is not unusual. CGM should not become a standalone diagnostic tool. Recent commentary has emphasized that people without diabetes lack a clear framework for interpreting every glucose fluctuation. Constant data may produce confusion and needless anxiety, with questionable public health benefit when cost and interpretation are not addressed thoughtfully. The same caution applies in type 2 diabetes, although the clinical rationale for monitoring is much stronger there. A single 180 Moirbauer DL reading should not be catastrophized. It should be placed next to the preceding meal, the medication regimen, the sleep window, the activity log, and the broader CGM report. Not all wearables are equivalent. The FDA has explicitly warned consumers not to rely on smartwatches or smart rings that claim to measure glucose without piercing the skin, because no such devices had been authorized for that purpose at the time of the warning. Clinicians should ask exactly what device the patient is using and whether it has been cleared for glucose measurement. CGM can also amplify health inequity. Sensors carry meaningful out-of-pocket costs. Insurance rules vary by state and plan, and some patients need help downloading reports or interpreting the AGP's colored bands. When ongoing access is limited, a structured professional CGM trial lasting 10 to 14 days can still be useful, especially when the visit is built around one clear clinical question. Turning sensor data into better conversations. A useful clinical rhythm starts simple. The patient wears CGM for 10 to 14 days while changing as little as possible about food, movement, or sleep. The goal is not perfect behavior. The goal is an honest picture of ordinary life. The next visit converts the AGP into a single clinical question. Why does breakfast produce a steep rise? Why does dinner stay elevated for hours? Why does glucose drift upward overnight? One focused question is more actionable than 10 ambient alarms. Then comes the first experiment, and it should be small and safe. A patient might add protein or fiber to breakfast, trim a portion of refined carbohydrates, or rearrange the meal. Crossover trials in adults with type 2 diabetes show that eating vegetables and protein first, with concentrated carbohydrates last, can cut postprandial glucose peaks by roughly half compared with the reverse sequence. The intervention is simple, requires no new food, and translates well into ordinary meals. Movement is another high-yield experiment. Meta-analyses of post-meal exercise show that walking soon after eating blunts, the glucose rise more effectively than the same walk hours later or before the meal. Even 10 minutes after a meal can flatten the CGM trace visibly. That makes walking a perfect first experiment for a patient who needs to see results quickly. The CGM provides immediate, motivating feedback that persists in the clinician's absence. A second experiment can address context: sleep loss, high stress, pain flares, alcohol, infection, steroid courses, and late eating can all reshape glucose patterns. Behavioral clinicians can help patients test these variables one at a time, using the CGM as a hypothesis checker rather than as a verdict generator. Medication conversations belong squarely in this rhythm. If TAR remains high despite feasible lifestyle changes, the CGM report becomes evidence for an informed discussion with the prescribing clinician about therapy adjustment. If TBR appears, especially in a patient using insulin or a sulfonylurea, a safety review should happen promptly. The CGM is not a substitute for prescribing judgment, but it is excellent shared data. The final piece is naming the win. For many adults with diabetes, the consensus goal is at least 70% TIR with minimal TBR, individualized for age, pregnancy, comorbidity, hypoglycemia risk, and treatment burden. For some patients, the first meaningful win is fewer breakfast peaks, less time above 180 mAdmr DL, or a lower CV. Naming a small, achievable target is what builds the self-efficacy that sustains change. Integrative summary. CGM is best understood as a pattern recognition tool. It reveals what fasting glucose and HbA1c routinely hide. The daily rhythm of meals, movement, stress, sleep, medication, and recovery. In type 2 diabetes, that rhythm matters because repeated high exposure may, over time, contribute to nerve, vascular, kidney, and retinal injury. The thesis holds with two guardrails. First, spikes over 160 mg DL are clinically meaningful, but not a proven sharp threshold for damage. Second, CGM improves care only when the data are interpreted in the context of education, safety planning, equitable access, and psychological context. For healthcare providers, the practical promise of CGM is not more numbers. It is a better conversation. CGM helps patients trade vague failure narratives for testable hypotheses, smaller experiments, and more compassionate self-management. The technology cannot deliver that outcome on its own. Clinicians and patients can build it together with the data the sensor provides. Five takeaways. 1. CGM is most powerful as patterned feedback, not as a verdict on a patient or a meal. 2. A1C and fasting glucose can look acceptable, while post-meal peaks still occur between 160 and 180 mBr DL. 3. A repeated pattern above 160 mmHg DL deserves clinical attention, but a single spike should not be treated as proof of injury. 4. The most useful CGM intervention is a small, safe experiment with food order, post-meal walking, sleep, stress, or medication review. 5. Behavioral health clinicians can help patients use CGM with curiosity, self-compassion, and safety rather than shame, perfectionism, or alarm fatigue.